From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made a couple of weeks ago when we welcomed four scientists to the show to discuss the recent March for Science around the world. Late in that hour, a listener emailed to say that he's frustrated with American politics. Specifically, this listener lamented his view that believing in climate science is politically risky, but believing in the divinity of Jesus Christ is a path to political power. And that had us thinking, in this politically charged country, how compatible is science with faith? Can they coexist? Evolutionary biologist Jerry Coyne says they simply cannot. In Coyne's newest book, he says that faith is believing without evidence, which is incompatible with the scientific method. But plenty of others have said there is a place for science and faith to work side by side. Now, we don't believe in third rail issues on Connections. We'll discuss anything as long as it's done in a civil fashion. And this hour, it's a conversation about the relationship, if there is one, between science and faith. Let me go ahead and welcome my guests for the hour. They include Reverend Eric Thompson, who is the priest in charge at St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Dansville. Reverend Thompson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Dan Courtney is here. He's an engineer and a member of the Atheist Society of Rochester, a co-founder. Let's see here. Dan, what did you co-found, by the way? The Young Skeptics Club,
right?
Young
Skeptics, yes.
The Young Skeptics, which was where?
Well, we're actually nationwide. We've taken a break from having a local club at the moment to expand our curriculum, but we're essentially franchising Young Skeptics as an after-school club around the country.
All right, so before we continue the conversation, a brief hello from News Director Randy Gorbin, who's also in studio.
And thank you, Evan. I want to say these are the kinds of topics that, let's face it, you hear on public broadcast, you don't hear on a lot of other places. As Evan, we were kind of joking before he came on, something non-controversial for Pledge Week. Yeah. We'll be talking about the intersection of science and faith. But really, where else do we get a civil discourse? I mean, you can put on your cable networks, your other TV radio stations. You'll get a lot of yelling, but you're not going to get the informative, intelligent, really kind of a conversation that we need to have in this country on issues that are all too often all too polarizing. But we need your help to continue to support the kinds of efforts we do here. We are member-driven, as you know. If you're a regular listener to this program, you can help out by making a call right now to 454-6300, 454-6300. The toll-free number, 1-800-295-9994. That's 1-800-295-9994. Or make a safe, secure donation online at either wxxinews.org or weos.org. Whatever you can, $5, $10 a month, and make it an easy way to budget yourself that way. But again, we need your support to continue the kinds of programming that you are hearing during the next couple of hours.
Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
Appreciate that. Before we dive in here, I just want our guests to tell us a little bit more about their backgrounds. And Reverend Thompson, as the priest in charge at St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Dansville, if I remember correctly, you reached out to me and said, you kind of raised your hand and said, this is a subject that's sort of dear to your heart. Why is that?
Well, from the time I was very small, I loved science. It was my first academic love. At the same time, in our household, we were occasional churchgoers and then became regular churchgoers.
Grew up where, by the way?
I grew up in lots of places. I was a military brat.
Mm-hmm.
And so many places in the South, but ultimately settled in Tennessee after my father retired. My mother was chronically ill, so we had lots of engagement with medical science as we went through that process. And so early on, there was my own curiosity, our household situation, and then an increasing involvement with a local parish church of a different denomination in Tennessee. And for me, in our household, it was perfectly acceptable and actually expected that we would be curious, that we would take reality rather seriously, that we would perform well academically. And my parents, as I started to encounter them as human beings and not just my parents, I encountered them as being people with a nuanced and broad perspective on faith and religion, even though they each had their own respective practices. My father being very, very intellectual, my mother being very, very compassionate, but also curious. And so I would kind of get different perspectives on some of the same things. At the same time, my mother being ill, we were dependent greatly on medical science to not only sustain her life, but hopefully create some opportunities with treatment. And at the same time, we had a close relationship with this parish church. I developed my own sense of a vibrant faith. So when it came time to go through what it became a transplant process for my mother. When I would pray, that the transplant would happen and that it would work out. I wouldn't pray in kind of a magical adult letter to Santa Claus
God,
kind of way.
God heal her.
Healing with a rather complicated, thoughtful approach, not wake up one morning and everything's magically different for my mother, but rather that the process would work out favorably for us in a way of kind of coming to terms with what reality and the long shot that we were facing was. And for me, that was normal. That was a normal way to engage my religious tradition that I was coming up in that I took seriously. And at the same time, early on, I had conflict with Sunday school teachers because I liked science. So when they started, when I was in eighth grade and they started, taking a fifth grade read of the Bible to reject evolution, I would start sneaking out into the Sunday school class my father taught, which used historical critical text criticism and took a more collegiate approach to it. And so I was early on the square peg in the round hole as far as going on to get along with other people who were in the same church
as me. So you saw some conflict with science, rejection of evolution, but that didn't derail your faith. You kind of just seemed to kind of circumvent what they were trying to teach you about that.
What I knew from my parents' example, and I think all of us, some of our primordial examples are from our parents, was that it was bigger than the person teaching it. The experience of that which was holy, which I'm using 40-year-old experience and theology degrees, to speak in those terms, to encounter that which is holy, goes beyond the language, the sacred texts, and even the community to something bigger. And I had an inkling of it then, and ultimately wandered out of what was becoming a more fundamentalist approach in that church, and spent a little time on my own, actually, in high school, trying to decide what I wanted to do with all things religion. And wandered into the tradition I'm in now, which is the Episcopal Church, which is pro-science, and there's lively debate around the interaction of theology and science. And none of it is, there's no problem whatsoever, but rather, can we have a constructive dialogue? What does it mean for belief when we've seen our planet from orbit? When we see these images from the Hubble Space Telescope, what does it mean when we start talking about ultimate things?
And you don't reject evolution?
Absolutely not. Yeah. Absolutely not. If you accept medical science, you have to accept evolution. So many religious people in this country are fine with technological developments that make our military more lethal and our soldiers more safe. And yet suddenly when we start talking about human origins or cosmic origins, everybody gets nervous. Well, wait a minute. We can do better. And if we're in for a penny, we're in for a pound, because if you're going to accept what the scientific method reveals in one field of study, why would you not at least try to engage in good faith what the scientific method reveals in another field? And do we have to define faith and belief in such ways that there's always going to be conflict, or can we be creative and constructive there as well?
All right, so you're the priest in charge of St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Dansville now. You've been doing that for how long?
Right at 1 year. I've been ordained for about 12 years. I've been in ministry of some sort for about 14, and landed back in Dansville. And I'm very happy to be there and have settled and are looking forward to raising our kids there.
All right, so there's a little bit of Reverend Thompson's background. Dan Courtney gave you a little bit of it. First time that Dan and I talked on this program was probably back when the hubbub was happening in Greece, probably, Dan?
Yeah, down in Greece. I think it was almost 3 years ago.
Oh, boy. Time flies, I guess. What's the reminder, the snapshot for the listeners who forgot that episode?
Yeah, there was a Supreme Court ruling regarding the town of Greece here near Rochester, and what the town of Greece was doing was having predominantly Christian invocations before their meetings. And a local atheist brought a lawsuit through Americans United through separation of church and state. And the Supreme Court ruled in the favor of the town, essentially saying their process of picking those that gave an invocation was just fine. Although, in my personal opinion, what they presented to the court was disingenuous. It was not the same as what they were actually doing. So in any event, as soon as that ruling came down, I put myself on the list as the first non-believer to actually give an invocation before the town of Greece.
Okay. And so Dan's also, as he describes himself, an atheist activist, co-founder of Young Skeptics. And so let's talk a little bit about the question that kind of came up a couple of weeks ago. Dan, I'll start with you, and then I'll turn to Reverend Thompson. You know, and I don't want to bring this up in a manner that is aggressive or sort of leaning in any direction, but I took that listener's email, and I got to wondering, if we raise our kids to believe in something without evidence, and Reverend Thompson might reject this whole premise, or maybe not, but let's start with this. If we've defined faith as believing something without evidence, and we celebrate that in a way, do we risk raising kids to be poor reasoners? In other words, outside of the creator of the universe and how the universe is sort of structured, day-to-day life, if you teach them on the big question, to believe something without evidence, are we going to be putting them in a position to not be very good at reasoning and requiring evidence for other things? What do you think, Dan?
Well, I think the short answer is yes. What you're doing is, not that the children can't be raised to be good critical thinkers, and my children were actually brought up with religious education. They went to a private Catholic school until about the eighth grade. And they would often come home to me, and they would make claims.
Hold on, back this up here. Your kids went to private Catholic school until the eighth grade?
Yes.
Were you an atheist at the time?
I was probably questioning at the time.
Interesting.
My wife at the time was Catholic. She still is Catholic, ex-wife now. And she essentially insisted on sending them to Catholic school, and I did not object.
Okay. All right. So continue.
And they did get a good quality education. And some of that is because of self-selection. You know, parents are invested financially and otherwise in getting a good education. But in any event, they would come home to me with certain claims, and I would have to essentially walk them through the process of critical thinking, asking them, you know, what is the evidence for this, and helping them essentially become good, critical, autonomous thinkers. So it didn't prevent them, as young adults now, from being, you know, intelligent, good, critical thinkers, but it was an extra hurdle that we had to overcome. And I think there are lots of kids that don't have the advantage of having a parent who themselves understands the process of critical thinking, and they may just accept, and they may, in fact, even reinforce certain ideas based upon faith, again, which is essentially believing something either without or in spite of evidence. And that really handicaps the kids throughout the rest of their lives.
Okay. Reverend Thompson, do you agree with the premise of defining faith as a belief without evidence, or is that not a good place to start your view?
I would start by saying, if you're going to define it that way, then we can all go to lunch, because I think that would be case closed. And in fact, certainly some religious traditions do define it as exactly that. If faith is intellectual acceptance of the improbable or the preposterous, it's incompatible with the scientific method. It's incompatible with critical thinking. And I think I would join you rather readily. There was a study done, and I'm going to be very poor in citing this source, but I picked it up, shared online, that they took a look at children enrolled in a parochial school, I don't know which particular tradition, were more likely to have difficulty separating out something being factual and something not being factual. They would hear a story, did the story really happen, and there would be they would be in less of a position to tell the difference. And my curiosity, of course, was, did they control for particular tradition? How was the study conducted, or was it just a survey? If faith is, to borrow from Paul Tillich, who was a theologian in the 20th century, ultimate concern and the state of being concerned ultimately, then that leads to other possibilities. Namely, that first of all, whatever your ultimate concern is, regardless of what you say is or isn't your religion, that's your God. That creates the possibility where someone might nominally identify as a Christian, but if you look, they're more interested in their career, their money, or their family. When I was an Army chaplain, we would talk a lot about this concept called spiritual fitness. And it frustrated me greatly, because it looked an awful lot like special events run by the chaplain, and that made me uncomfortable. And I wanted to find a way to talk about it in a way that would respect the Constitution and the separation of church and state, and the respecting of the needs of my soldiers, whether they were religious or not. And so I actually took a different route to talk about what spiritual fitness would be. And I said, after doing some thinking and some reading, I said, well, it's knowing, using, and joining what inspires you, what sustains you through difficulty, and what helps you make sense of your place in the universe. And that thing can be a theistic deity. That thing can be a philosophy. That thing can be science. There was a great deal of discussion when I was deployed from 2007 to 2009 about battle mind, because they were worried about resiliency training. And my read of it as just someone who hung out a lot with the soldiers was, well, these are people, whether they've not been taught to think critically or they've not been taught a certain set of values, they've not been connected with ways to endure and make sense of their situation. And that goes beyond traditional religious traditions or philosophies. That's just an anthropological challenge. Human beings, and I'm about to get in trouble, hopefully we'll have a great conversation. I believe human beings are inherently religious. But in the literal sense of the word, which comes out of the Latin ligare, the same word we get ligament from, and your religion is understood that way as a way of tying everything together. Think the ties that bind. And human beings have to tie the information they're exposed to together. The theologian Phil Hefner once noted, human beings are basically a combination of genes and culture mediated by the central nervous system. And in our mediation of our environment and what we perceive, the way we do that, you know, de facto becomes our religion. And some religions want to do that in a way that creates a box, that creates real constraints on the questions that can be asked, that creates real constraints on the conclusions you can reach. And some religions, and I like to think mine gets in that direction, although we're far from perfect, is it's not a box, it's more of a loom. It's more of a mechanism to help weave everything together. And in the process of doing that, some parts of the tradition inevitably will endure, and some parts of the tradition will inevitably change, and some parts are probably left consigned to the dustbin of history.
But when you say, you know, for some people it can be a theistic deity that offers meaning, and for others it could be science, that sort of conflates the two. But a theistic I certainly want you to be able to respond. But if it's science, the process of science says that what we understand can be largely tested and sometimes invalidated, and our understanding evolves with it. Whereas a theistic deity, there isn't a whole lot of evolution in terms of how we view something, because there isn't a whole lot of ways to test it. And those do seem to be fundamentally different, no?
And I would agree with that. If you want me to try and make a case that any religious dogma can be proven by the scientific method, the only one I can get to is sin, and I can prove it by picking up a newspaper. And that's, you know, stuff is happening in the world that I think we all would agree is not good stuff. And I think it was Reinhold Niebuhr who said that the only Christian dogma that can be proven in any sense would be that one, and everything else is up for grabs. I can't prove religious dogma. I'm not going to try to prove religious dogma. To me, I think it's more about the process we go through. And you know, do we take a look at what science reveals through the method with anxiety, or do we take a look at it and use this as an opportunity to grow and develop and recognize that even though we hold certain things sacred, they have to evolve with us.
Okay, Dan Courtney.
Yeah, let me agree, disagree, and then agree again with the Reverend. And what I mean by that is, first of all, I wrote this down before coming in Hebrews 11. And I'll quote, faith means being sure of the things we hope for and knowing something is real even if we can't see it. And from what I understand, the Reverend is essentially rejecting that idea of faith, the idea that it's essentially wishful thinking. Where I'm going to disagree is that religious doctrine, you have to remember that, we'll talk about the Bible as the source here, it was written at a time before we had formalized scientific methods. Now, I think that the writers of the Bible, the authors, multiple authors, really made, and pardon the pun, a good faith effort to represent reality as it was or as it is. Now, they didn't know what we know today. That's why they talked about the firmament, the dome over the earth. The earth is essentially a flat disk, and the stars being placed in the firmament, the separation of the waters and so forth, all you can find in Genesis. They didn't write that at the time as the way it's interpreted now, as an allegory, as a symbolic representation. It was written clearly at the time as an actual representation of reality. So I think we need to understand the way it was written at the time. Now, it's been redefined in order to be compatible in some sense with what we understand as far as geology and other sciences, biology and so forth. And that's essentially a rescuing mechanism so that we can still claim to believe in a sense or to have faith in some sense without having to reject what's obviously true from what we understand with science. Where I'm going to agree again with the Reverend is that I think we are inherently religious. Now, what I mean by that is there's something that's called theory of mind. When you're about 4 years old, 3 or 4 years old, you actually develop this capability to be able to see things from another person's perspective. So, for example, if a child hides something in a box and their parent's out of the room, before the age of about four, the parent comes into the room, the child would not understand that the parent wouldn't know that the toy or whatever that's hidden in the box is in the box. After about four, they can understand that because they didn't see it go into the box, they wouldn't have an idea that's in there. This gets into the idea of intentionality, that being able to project yourself into somebody else's position and to see their point of view and to see what their intention might be is a very, very important human attribute that we develop. Now, in my view, this idea that we're inherent religious means that we have this super intentionality idea, and we project that onto things that don't have intention, like nature, for example. We were talking before, I live up on the shore of Lake Ontario. The water level is rising. Now, if I was an uber religious person, I might feel that maybe I did something wrong to not please the gods, and they're making it rain, and the water's coming up to punish me somehow. But because I am a critical thinker and think scientifically, I understand that there's no reason to believe there's any intentionality to the rising of the water. That's just what happens. So in that sense, I think we can agree that we are inherent religious, but we have to work through the process of critical thinking and thinking logically to essentially overcome that human bias.
All right. So let me see if I can frame this properly as we continue the discussion with our guest. You just heard Dan Courtney, who is an atheist activist and an engineer and someone who's been very involved in the local community on those fronts. Reverend Eric Thompson is the priest in charge at St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Dansville. Reverend Thompson is essentially saying that the scientific method is vital. It's important. It is really valuable, but that doesn't mean that it supplants faith and an understanding and the broader values that come along with faith. That people of faith can celebrate science, lift it up and raise it up, and not at all feel like it threatens necessarily their view of the universe. Whereas Dan is saying there's something sort of inherently at odds with one another. And what I want to do is ask Reverend Thompson to respond to something that Jerry Coyne wrote about this subject. He's an evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago, and he is the author of the recent book, Faith Versus Fact. And he writes, quote, "It is time for us to stop seeing faith as a virtue and to stop using the term person of faith as a compliment," because he goes on to say that since the beginning, man has been trying to find answers to the mysteries of the universe, and religion has always offered answers. But Coyne writes that over time, religion has been shown to be wrong or fraudulent, with the answers coming in the direction of science. He writes that never once has man discovered an answer to something via science, only to eventually move back in the direction of faith for an explanation. And here's how he assesses faith's record of teaching the natural world. Quote, "A failure of religion to find out the truth about anything," end quote. So what Jerry Coyne is saying, Reverend Thompson, is go back thousands of years. The rain, the thunder, those were all, you know, sort of attributed to the gods. As Dan said, the rising lake waters. We laugh now, or most of us. I saw you laughing at that idea. Most people would laugh at that now, but the idea being that those things are all attributed to the gods reacting to man, and that what Coyne is saying is that over time, the more we understand, the more we can scientifically test, the more technology has aided us, it's always moved away from the direction of, well, the gods or God is doing this, to, oh, here's the natural explanation. And never once has we said, oh, we thought that was scientific, but it turns out that this was Poseidon, or this was Jesus, or this was a religious explanation. And because of that, he says, the scientific method cannot be compatible with faith. Where is that wrong?
I don't think it is the way he's described it. Honestly, I don't believe that religion, the purpose of religion is to answer all the questions. I think the way I've come to understand it, the only way I could continue to be religious in any meaningful sense would be to understand it as it's a process. It's a way that we connect with one another and the way we connect to things we think are ultimate, whether they're ultimate or not. And that's one of the things I would tell my soldiers is, you know, you may have someone who claims that they're religious or that you know, the military is the most important thing or their country or whatever, but what really is getting them excited about something is less than that. And if you have to push to something deeper and deeper and deeper to move past what is inherently very temporary to something that is more permanent. Now, do I know what more permanent really is ultimately? No. And I want to be quite clear that I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the purpose of religion was to have all the answers. As the questions changed, religions did get things wrong. When Genesis was edited together by at least four authors, they were not trying to give the final account on how the world was made. Genesis chapter 1, and I'll pause and say, John Dominic Crossan likes to say that it's not that they wrote things literally and we're smart enough to take things allegorically. Scholarship in that realm clearly points to them writing things in many cases allegorically, and we're dumb enough to take them literally in many cases. The first chapter of Genesis was, if you go through the sequence, yes, it's a three-tiered universe, and we know that seeing our planet from outer space or watching the mast of a ship come up over the horizon before the rest of it does chucks that away, soundly. But if you look at it from a relational point of view, what you see is to people who are at the time in captivity by people who have sun gods and star gods and other kinds of deities, what it is saying to the people who are hearing it and then hearing the old stories that have been re-included in the rest of Genesis, because all of that was in the oral tradition and not even necessarily Hebrew when it got started, what you have is the pantheon of another country being demoted into the created order. It's not saying that the sun's not a nuclear reaction, because they weren't thinking in those terms. They were saying that the sun and all these other things that are being held up as deities around you are actually part of the created order. You know that created order is blessed. You know it's of God. Now keep the Sabbath. That's Genesis chapter 1, and that's really its main purpose. And it horrifies me. It frustrates me. Two things frustrate me. It frustrates me when people of faith read something that was actually carefully edited together at about a fifth or sixth grade level, except I know fifth and sixth graders smarter than that. And it also frustrates me then when critics of religion also read it at that same level, there's actually a great deal of historical critical scholarship going into it, to see that there's more going on there than just the superficial read of the text. And in the age of religious fundamentalism, I can understand why people are there. I can understand why if you've got somebody, quoting scripture in your face literally, that the best thing to do, is debunk it, to shoot them down. But I would note that even Neil deGrasse Tyson says that the minute you label somebody something, you transfer all the baggage to them, which is why he eschews all labels except the label scientist. He avoids the label atheist for that reason, which is not to—I don't want to get into what he actually believes.
No, I've heard him say exactly
but
that.
But don't That's transfer right. all the baggage. So don't assume all people who identify with a religious tradition read it that way. But I agree. This society does give too much deference to somebody who says, I have faith. And I think that's being borne out in our political polarization. Hmm. I think it gives too many people a free pass. I think it has interfered with human rights, which I find offensive both in terms of my religious tradition and as just a citizen of planet Earth. So in that sense, I can absolutely join the criticism of the use of faith and how it becomes a shield for some terribly, terribly bad behavior.
Interesting. Well, I think our guests maybe have a little more common ground than they thought, and certainly some differences. And we're going to get to some of your phone calls when we come back. So let's do this. Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll get your phone calls in. There's two other things I want to make sure we address before the hour is out as well. If you have an assumption that evangelicals, whatever, again, categorical, whatever baggage comes with it, as Reverend Thompson reminds us, but whatever your assumption is about what evangelicals think of science, I've got some numbers for you that may not be exactly what you assume. We'll get those. We'll also talk about climate science and the concern that some people of probably a fundamentalist faith origins, how they feel about climate science, and is faith impacting climate science. So we're going to hit that, and we'll take your phone calls as well. Reverend Eric Thompson is the priest in charge at St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Dansville. Dan Courtney is a local atheist activist, among other vocations and avocations, and we'll get those phone calls when we come back. Coming up in our second hour, Dr. Joe Dilley is my guest in studio. He's the author of the new book, The Game is Playing Your Kid. It's all about games, mobile technology, devices that are impacting our kids' development. And he's got ideas about how parents should be structuring their household to make sure kids are protected from this kind of mobile technology. So what are his suggestions? We'll find out next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Messner Flooring, servicing the commercial and residential flooring markets of Rochester for 55 years. Messner Flooring, adore your floor. More online at messnercarpet.com.
Only the briefest of interruptions from our news director, Randy Gorbin, who's here to say, well, what do you have, Randy? Hi.
How are you, Evan? I want to say that this is a great discussion, and if you enjoy what you hear, not only during Connections, but of course during our coverage all day, and a lot of people listen to, I know, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the great news department. I have to say, on behalf of all the folks who work there, just do an amazing job. Great Lakes Today, all those people. It all takes money to run that, and that's why we have to do these pledge drives a couple of times a year. We could use your help right now. You can call 454-6300. 454-6300, toll free 1-800-295-9994, 1-800-295-9994, or you can just make your donation online. A safe, secure way to do that at wxxinews.org or weos.org, and you can make any kind of donation you want, even $5 a month, not even the cost of a latte, and this is a lot less frothy. You have some really good discussion.
That's good. I like that.
I worked on that all morning. You know what? What is Connections not like? It's not like a latte.
No, not at all. Not a lot
but
of
it's
froth.
A great discussion today.
Thank you.
I hope people will support this.
Thank you, Randy. Appreciate that. So on the question of whether evangelicals oppose science, the answer is a couple of things. First of all, yes, much more so than the general public, but perhaps not as much as you might assume. So here's a comment from Elaine Howard Eklund, who's a sociologist at Rice University, who orchestrated a survey. And she said, although many politicians and the media at large portray evangelicals as distrustful of science, we found that that is more myth than reality. So among evangelical Christians, about 48% said that they see science and religion as complementary to one another, while 21% think science and religion refer to entirely different aspects of reality and see them as independent of one another. So essentially almost 70% say either they kind of go hand in hand or they're two totally different things. They don't have to, you know, sort of oppose each other. But the share of evangelical Christians who think religion and science are in conflict and see themselves on the side of religion and against science is 29%. That's more than double the figure of the general U.S. population, which is 14%. So point being is, you know, yes, 2-1, evangelicals think science is a problem compared to religion to the general public, but the vast majority think it either can coexist or it's an entirely separate idea. So there are some numbers for you to digest as we continue the conversation. And let me grab our first phone call. It's Debbie in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Debbie.
Hi, I'm the Presbyterian pastor at the Ontario Center Presbyterian Church. And I wanted to make a couple of comments that I think might help flesh all this out. One of the things I appreciated Reverend Thompson talking about what Genesis is trying to do, I would take it further. And what I teach a lot is that the writing of Genesis 1, particularly 1 and 2, is in contrast to the other creation stories that were around the people of Israel at the time. The Babylonians had a story in which the world is born out of violence, in which people are created to serve God kind of as slaves. And in opposition to this, the Israelites wrote that the world was made out of love, out of a desire for relationship. And that people are been given stewardship by God, in some ways working right alongside God and carrying out, continuing God's work. And so it's not the same kind of story. They are telling a story of a different kind of God and a different kind of relationship of people to God. And that gets back to the fundamental questions I think you all are asking. The Bible's really witnessing to God about people in relation to God. It's telling us who we are in relation to God and who that God is. And so that really has been a different question than scientific proof. They're not asking the same sorts of things. And that leads to the faultiness of the faith definition you started with, because faith is really a verb, and it's connected to the word trust. So it's really trusting God with our lives, in our lives, and that is what preachers and faith teachers, faith formation teachers, spend so much time on, pointing to where God's working in the world, in our lives, and making a difference that is coherent with the witness to God that we see through Scripture.
All right, Debbie, could stay on the line if you could. First of all, thank you for taking the time to call. Dan Courtney is the atheist on the panel. You want to respond to some of what you heard?
Yeah, I think what we're headed towards with Debbie's comment is what we call pantheism, which is the idea that the universe as a whole is the God that we're talking about. If no. not that, then no. what you're saying, that God is somehow separate from reality as a whole. God is some type of separate entity. The problem is there is only one reality, and there can be aspects of reality, and we could talk about our relationship to that reality or to nature or to each other, but as far as objectively understanding that reality, this idea of trust or faith really just doesn't get us there. We can certainly trust something, but we should have evidence behind it that allows us to have that trust, something that can be objectively verified.
Well, Debbie was kind enough to email as well. Debbie, if you don't mind, let me just read part of your email, and then I'll let you respond to what Dan just said, if that's okay.
Sure.
You write, "There is all sorts of evidence of God working in people's lives, and that's what faith formation is about, teaching us to see the effects of God's presence in our lives and in the world." But again, when we get back to evidence, Can you show me that what you see as God working in someone's life is actually that? I mean, and when I say show me, can you show me via a scientific method? Can you prove to me that this is evidence of God working in someone's life versus a trust or a hope that's what that you're looking at?
Right. So I would agree with Reverend Thompson that those two things are just not getting at the same thing. And I would have to say to Dan that definitely I do not believe in pantheism, where God is everything or everything is God. Panentheism I would accept, because that means God is in all things. And that I think there's great scriptural truth for. I think when we're coming from an aspect of faith, we're starting with the witness of Scripture, which is telling us about the relationship. And then we are living our lives in that relationship as we go through the day, which is very different than if you're living in relation to something else. So it's the relationship you have through your faith or through your faith to each other and to the rest of the world.
Okay. Dan, any follow-up there? And then we'll kind of move on here.
Yeah, I think with all due respect, Debbie, you're still talking about some type of separate reality. And without an objective means of establishing what that is, I just don't know where you're going with that.
May I?
Yeah, go ahead, Reverend
quickly,
Thompson.
I actually would say that it's not a separate reality. It is revealed in this reality. Okay, reveal. Let me back up. It is not a separate reality in the sense that we might imagine the old pantheon illustrations where us lowly humans are here on the earth, or even the Genesis 1 cosmology where, you know, there's the dome and then up above that and then, you know, all the heavenly beings are way up there and then who knows what's down below other than maybe some of my relatives. But the idea that the Creator has a style. This is something my wife was commenting. She's also a seminarian. Is that, you know, when you look at images from the Hubble Space Telescope, or close-ups of the human iris, or the presence of mathematical consistencies at various at the micro and macro level, and those kinds of things, what we do is we look at it at that and know there's no, you know, testable by the scientific method way to demonstrate this, but we would look at that and we would say that that's actually the style of the Creator. that science for us, for people of faith, reveals to us more about what we claim to believe, more about the who, and perhaps even the how. And that's important to understand. Is we do not, you know, for people of faith who have no anxiety about science, we're not trying to establish in our own religions the what. We're not trying to establish even the when. We are trying to establish, in our own traditions, the who, and then whatever insights can be brought to bear out of that. So for us, our focus really is more relational. Yes, there was a time when bishops were trying to figure out exactly when the world was created, and I think so many of us who still identify with a religious tradition just aren't even there, and we really would have a hard time relating
but
to that.
But Reverend, what I hear Dan saying, to kind of shorten this, because I know we got other calls to take in, I really appreciate Debbie taking the time to call as well. What I hear Dan saying is simply, you can talk about the value that religion and faith brings to you, you can talk about relationships, but if you use the word evidence, and when we are talking about whether faith and science can coexist, evidence has a very specific meaning.
Yes,
you shouldn't use the word evidence if you don't mean evidence.
Well, and I'll concede that a mountain of anecdote is not going to accommodate what some kind of testable, repeatable process is. I don't think we're not trying to pick that fight. I don't think she is, and I certainly am not trying to pick that fight.
All right, Debbie, some response there, and we'll let you go. Thank you for the call. Go ahead, Debbie.
I totally agree. Yes, thank you for taking the call.
Yeah, thank you so much. Dan?
Yeah, I just want to say that when we're talking about, for example, the beauty of the iris or a shot from the Hubble Space Telescope, what we're doing is essentially imputing our own human values and our style, our ideas of style into nature itself. And so what we're doing is projecting ourselves. And it says more about us than about this other separate idea of reality.
All right, Michael in Geneva is next on the phones. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
To put myself into context, I'm 32. I went back to school late. I have decided that the best thing I can do with my life is to try to find a way to make the world a better place. And the objective standpoint that I come from is, where is our common ground as human beings? What do we all share, regardless of the political conflict, the social conflict, the cultural conflicts that we're enduring? What is our common ground? And our common ground, ultimately, I believe, is that we all want to be loved, we all want to be valued and respected, and we all want to feel as though we belong in our place in life. And this innate conflict between religion and faith, as we have progressed as a species, I believe this time in our existence will be looked back upon as a transitional period, where we have really taken the leap from the ledge of faith or religion, as it were, into a stronger belief and a stronger respect to the evidential scientific discoveries that we have. Now, that being said, I do believe that we ultimately, in the grand picture of our existence, will never completely be able to define the cosmos. I believe we will always have some portion of our existence that we are unable to attain an explanation for. And that being said, I do believe genuinely that there is a way for faith and science to coexist. Science admits that there are things that it cannot explain. Faith rests on itself. It says this is the way, and I think Dan was the one expressing that faith, in a way, negatively, is used as a shield to sanctify beliefs or actions and behaviors that are a little dangerous. But I think that faith, by most, is something that they rest on, something that they put their hopes in, something that they put their dreams in. And from that respect, it's a beautiful thing. I myself developed a lot of my perspective and my worldview from self-proclaimed anti-theists and atheists such as Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, but I was raised Roman Catholic, and I live in Geneva, which is a predominantly Catholic community. But as I've grown into my adulthood, I've certainly been able to step back from it and view things from a more objective standpoint, and I've been able to take faith and place it in an objective light to view it for its pros and its cons, and it does bring people together. and it encourages love. It encourages unconditional acceptance of one another. But again, there are sides of it that some folks take and use improperly. And the other side of that is that science also demeans faith in ways. It demeans the idea that we would just almost ignorantly accept something without evidence. And ultimately, I believe through the course of our existence, it's important for us to search for evidence, search for answers, but in places where there may not be answers attainable, accept that it's okay to accept that we can't explain it, but that doesn't mean that there isn't something at work that is real. And so ultimately, if I wanted to tie my whole little ramble together here, it would be that I do believe in a creator to our universe. I do believe in intention. I do believe there is design. But I also believe that we are able to peer into it with scientific evidence. We look at images from the Hubble or images, close-up images of the iris or the complexities of our biological makeup otherwise. There is evidence of a creator in my mind. There is intention, the way that the planet functions, cycles. I do believe there is a natural order, but I also believe that we as human beings, we encompass our own natural order.
All right, well, and Michael, let me just thank you for the phone call. Let me just jump in and say I see a lot of sort of love and beauty in what Michael is offering. My guess is Dan would say a lot of what you see as a creator is sort of the God of the gaps idea, that we're moving in the direction of fulfilling it. But I also see a lot of beauty in what Michael is saying, and at least an ethos of saying, we can coexist. Let's be honest. Faith is not going away. We are seeing a society moving, especially in younger generations, more atheistic, but certainly not predominantly, not in a majority way. So I think Michael's phone call is a good point for me to ask, especially Reverend Thompson, if he agrees. You know, he referenced something that you actually said, which is that faith can be used as a shield for bad or hurtful ideas, which you don't want to see happen. And, you know, here's Jerry Coyne concerned that climate science is going to be injured by sort of faith, and he points to, for example, Illinois Representative John Shimkus gave Genesis-based testimony before a House subcommittee, essentially arguing that God is going to save this planet. God is in charge, that this idea that we've got to re-engineer energy consumption, that kind of policy, we are disrespecting God, God's in control. And Coyne looks at that and says, this man is elected to Congress, and that eventually he can set policy, and this is an example of where faith can impact a specific scientific idea. Do you share that kind of concern?
Very much so. It's hard to know where to quite start on that one because there's just several layers of wrong.
Well, how about the idea that God's in charge and that God made this beautiful planet, but eventually, you know, Jesus will return and God is in control.
And how much suffering are we willing to tolerate on that bet? And I'm just not in that position to do that. To use Genesis, since everybody likes to go there, the image of dominion in Genesis, you know, where the creations turfed to the humans and said, fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it. Dominion is there understood by scholars as the way a king would exercise dominion. And a king is morally responsible for the outcomes. A king is not let off the hook for things done wrong on his watch. And by the same token, the idea that somehow because of that or because of someone's understanding of eschatology that we're going to get some cosmic bailout from messing our nest, I just don't buy it. We do have separation of church and state in this country despite ongoing assaults to that. No elected representative should be basing a policy strictly on an interpretation of a sacred text or religious dogma.
Let me challenge Dan Courtney as we get ready to finish the hour, because what I've heard from Reverend Thompson is a humility. I think it's a respect for the scientific method, but not a rejection of faith on that basis. And that humility is important. And Dan, when we had the scientists on the program talking about the March for Science, the dean of research at the University of Rochester worried about occasional arrogance on the scientific community that doesn't build bridges, that doesn't reach out to, for example, the 29% of evangelicals who view science in conflict. How are we going to build bridges going forward?
Well, I think I'll agree with Mike and his call in one respect is we certainly aren't going to know everything. And science is built on the idea that—
Probably ever, yeah.
Yeah, ever. I mean, there's certain things that we'll— no reason to believe that we'll ever know. So I think we have to have a certain amount of humility in science and understanding that there's a limit to what we can know and how quickly we can learn things. But at the same time, still addressing Mike, this underlying idea that there's some type of, as the Reverend said, cosmic intent, I think that's what we have to really work to overcome, because that leads directly to what you were saying, is that there's somehow this idea that God will come in and save our planet, and there's nothing we could do to hurt it with climate change and so forth that God can't fix. I think that's the type of dangerous thinking that leads to. So we need to understand that it's perfectly natural to believe that there's an intent, and we have to work through thinking critically to be able to understand that there's no reason to believe that there is an intent in nature itself.
We could have done both hours on this program today. And I just have to say, I really respect both of our guests for coming in, agreeing at spots, maybe surprised to agree at spots, disagreeing at spots, but doing it civilly, because faith isn't going away. And science isn't going away, and I think we have to find a way to coexist. Reverend Thompson, see you down there in Dansville, and thank you for taking the time to come all the way in here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And Dan Courtney, always nice to have you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, short break. Much more Connections is next.